Hey, Barry.
Hi, Andone.
Hello, Scott.
Hello.
So today we have a guest speaker, a guest for the podcast. We got the chance because he was the keynote speaker at OpenConf here in Athens. So welcome to Athens and welcome to OpenConf and welcome to Mikri Kuveda or Smalltalk, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
It's really nice. So I think that we can start with a few words about your background.
Sure.
Just to get this started. So would you like to share a few things about what you currently do and a few things about the past?
Yeah, so I think the big thing is I was one of the co-founders of GitHub, which is, a service that I think most software developers use, most open source is probably on these days. Certainly wasn't the case when we first started it, but that's I worked there for 8-ish years.
So yeah,
I helped grow the company from about the four of us that were co-founders to I left when we were about 450 employees. So it was a relatively interesting, I think, growth story.
And then 100 times more.
Yeah, every time a company doubles, it's a new company. So I think I went through 8 companies at GitHub probably at that time. And then I left and I started a language learning company called Chatterbug, and it had me move to Berlin for that. And then I left that, and now I'm starting a version control system again called GitButler. It's another startup. So like I'm just kind of I love starting startups. I love kind of being a serial entrepreneur, I guess. But starting something, trying to put something out in the world, it's very, very interesting to me. So that's my background in a nutshell, I suppose.
So as GitHub grew, which step did you find to be the most challenging to follow, and why?
I suppose there are a couple. I mean, the beginning times I feel like were relatively difficult from a revenue standpoint because, we weren't making that much and we were kind of bootstrapping the company. And I left a job that I was making a good amount of money at as a professional developer and made maybe a quarter or something when I started GitHub. And so I was struggling, I think, financially, individually in the beginning. And I think that was relatively difficult. And then in the end, I think there was another sort of set of things, which was the company becomes so big, you don't know everybody in the company anymore. Like once it goes past 100 people or something, like it's very, very difficult to know 100 people relatively well. And so I think anytime a company scales, like you get to a point where, I mean, we were hiring, at the end of my time there, probably a dozen people every 2 weeks, right? And so it's like, that's the whole company for the first 3 years. Like every 2 weeks was added onto the company. And a lot of them are remote. And so I struggle with that a little bit in just not knowing who the company was, right? Or not knowing who worked in the company anymore or how to communicate with people in a human way. And so I think that was, those were kind of the two. One was kind of more personal and the other was just how do you run something that's larger than you expected the company to ever become? So those were probably the biggest struggles that I struggled. And I ended up, I think, leaving GitHub in some degree because I did want to have this smaller, more agile, more, can we reinvent something from scratch type company rather than, it was a thing on its way. Like it had its path, it knew where it was going. And there's less kind of, it's harder to change a moving ship at that point. So, every stage of it was interesting in different ways, I think, but those were probably the most challenging.
So I just want one more thing. I remember a quote from a friend from Antonis that we actually met in Berlin last year when we were there, and he has worked in multi settings and in big companies. And he was saying that as a company grows and passes over a number of employees, it starts to look more like a town afterwards because you can't help but have very different personalities, very different people, and the dynamics are quite different. You can't have that same thing of, coherency as you could before. Is that true or?
Yeah, no, 100%. Actually, our investors from Andreessen Horowitz, I think it was Mark at some point said that once your company culture is whatever 50% of your company thinks the company culture is, right? And so you can try to set it as founders and say, okay, this is what the company culture is. Here's the company culture values. Everybody memorize these. Everybody kind of enable the, like embody these things. But at some point, if you're hiring 50% of the company, you know, in 6 months, right? After the company's been around for 5 years, like, it's very hard to say this is what the company culture is, because really the company culture is probably whatever the last 6 months of hires were. Like it's what they think the company culture is. And we had, I think, a further, I don't know, advantage, disadvantage, complication, which was that we were like 50, 60% remote. And so we had a company culture that was remote, and we had a company culture that was in the office, and it was very hard to tell what is the amalgam of, like, what is the combination of all of the remote people think that the company culture is versus what are the people that you hang out with in the office think that it is versus, like, what's the whole company culture. So I think we struggle with that a lot of we had an idea of kind of what it was or what it should be or what we wanted to be. And then we'd hire, you know, 100 people in a couple months and be like, well, now, you know, that's half the company. So, like, what is the zeitgeist really of the whole company now? And I think, it's constantly difficult, because as founders as well, people don't necessarily want to tell you this is what's wrong or this is what's bad or, you know, this is a problem that we're having, unless there's secret channels or there's like different things or whatever. And it becomes very difficult to be sort of holistic on, okay, this is what we want the company to be. This is what the company thinks it is, right? This is what we think the company should be. Like, how do you, and you're not around face to face with half the company most of the time. So how do you make that whole? And I think we constantly struggle with that. And I think any company that splits itself, I mean, any company that gets to that size does, right? Like everybody, you can't know everybody in a 500 person company. Like, it's impossible to be like, this is what the company culture is. Like, the company culture is whatever it organically becomes. And when you hire fast, then it changes faster than you can help mold it, I guess, into what you want it to be.
Now that you were talking about remote, now remote is something that, you know, is very well known and something that a lot of companies actually do. But back then, because we're talking about 12, 13 years ago, I think that's about the time that it was, this was not the case, or at least it was not in Europe. Not if in the US it was quite different. So from seeing like a remote culture back then, and then was it something that you would like to, did you continue doing that in the companies afterwards, or?
It's a great question. So I think GitHub and a handful of other companies at that time were kind of trying to pave the way and make this be a thing that worked for them. So I know Automattic, so WordPress, like Matt Mullenweg, like they were trying to do this at the same time, and we kind of knew them and we were kind of sharing notes with them. And there were a handful of other companies that were trying to be like, we want to be fully remote, or we want to be largely remote, or we want to make a remote culture work, because there's so many upsides of having a remote company, right? And this is, I think really you can split it to before COVID and after COVID, because before COVID, it was really a choice. And after COVID, it became a necessity for everybody, whether they liked it or not, for at least a year. And then they had the chance or the choice, do we want to continue this or do we want to go back to how we were operating before? But we made the choice before COVID, before we had to say, we want to enable some, we want to take advantage of some parts of this. And some of the parts that were really valuable to us is that we knew people all over the world. We traveled all over. I spoke all over. We did conferences all over. And we knew people from all over the world. And we wanted to take the best people in open source, the best people in Ruby, the best people in, you know, MySQL, the best people in whatever technologies we were using, find them and say, hey, come work for us instead. You can work remotely. And it was a mixed bag because we were, A, I think, inventing the playbook as we went. There was not a lot of companies that did this, and certainly not a lot of companies at scale of hundreds or you know, several hundred or thousand or whatever. And almost no companies that did it really well. And so if you look at any company that we're trying to do remote, they would really be doing kind of, it depends on the split that you have. If you have 90-10, right? If it's like 90% in the office and 10% remote, it's horrible for everybody involved, right? If it's, and we ended up doing it kind of on a team basis. So some teams were completely in the office. Some teams were completely co-located. Some teams were completely remote. But the teams that didn't work well, I think, or the teams we had the most problems with were the ones that were split. So you had 60% in the office and 40% remote or something like that, because then they'd have lunches or they'd have conversations or whatever. Or we'd you know, acqui-hire a company, or we'd hire some people that had never really worked remote and they liked the idea of it because they could make a nice San Francisco salary, but, you know, work at home and in Wisconsin or whatever. And like, it was really difficult for them because they'd never done it before. And the ones that I think worked well were ones that where they were contractors or they had done this sort of professionally for a long time. And we're like, okay, well, now you're an employee, but you're still kind of working the same way. And they knew how to deal with that. Like, they knew how to not be in an office with people. They knew how to deal with imposter syndrome. They knew how to deal with you know, not being around people that did what they do every day and have that kind of camaraderie or that community. And so we had to invent all of that as we went, and companies like us had to do that as we went. And I gave talks and stuff on this, how we deal with this, how it works, how it doesn't work. And then it was kind of funny when COVID hit, because then we've done this forever. Like, I know exactly how all this goes, and all these companies are just being forced into figuring all of this out from scratch. I think to go back to your original point of do I do it or do I not do it in other startups, I prefer not. Okay. I actually don't. I understand very fundamentally and very strongly all of the advantages of remote work and all of the disadvantages. And it really comes down to personal preference, right? Mm-hmm. Like I like being in an office with people. I like going into a room like we're in right now and having a conversation and not doing this over Zoom. I much prefer doing this than doing this same type of thing over Zoom, even though it's really a similar conversation, right? But like, I feel like it's much more visceral. It's much more interesting. Like we connect more, or we have a different type of conversation. But I think it's the same in a company, where you want people in a room and you want them to whiteboard out stuff, or you want to have a lunch and you want to have dumb ideas, or you want to go for beers after work, or like, these are things you can't do over Zoom. It's just you can try, but like, it's not very easy to do. And I think especially for an early company, especially for a pre-product market fit company, like, it's valuable to have these connections, to have this empathy, right, between people that you don't get otherwise. And when you're trying to figure out how to make your mark in the world, and we had that at GitHub. Like, actually, we weren't remote until we were, I don't know, 10 people probably, right? Like, everybody was in San Francisco, and then we made sort of our first remote hire and tried to figure, we were like, well, we're all kind of working remotely anyways. We were kind of working as an open source product anyways. And so we're communicating over Slack, we're communicating over GitHub. Like, why not hire somebody that's not in the office? Like, we're all sitting in the office, not talking to each other 90% of the time anyways, but it's that 10% that makes a big difference. And so I think when you're really young and you're a really young company and you want to find your mark in the world, I think having people in the same place and being able to go out for, you know, dinner or beer, or whatever after work, I think it's invaluable. And so the company that I started after that was a language learning company called Chatterbug that was in Berlin. Almost everybody was co-located in the new company. GitButler is a version control system. We're trying to rethink version control, right, from first principles, from grounds up. And it's, I think it's invaluable to have somebody in the same, to have everybody in the same room and say, let's think about this every day. Like, what is working? What's not working? How can we iterate on this? It's so much faster. It's so much more visceral. And so I think for an early company, personally, it's not that it's not doable. I know people that do it, but I think, you know, I feel like I'm talking a really long time on this, but I feel like it should be, for an early company, it should be one or the other. Mm-hmm. Like, either you're a fully remote company and everyone's remote and you're 100% invested in that, and you invest in the infrastructure and you invest in everything that makes people feel comfortable in sharing ideas and coming up with concepts and iterating on work,
in an interesting way, and maybe get them together, you know, once a quarter, whatever, in a house somewhere, and you know, have a nice week together, and do sort of, this is kind of what we did, is like we would have these houses or whatever that everybody would be like, okay, it's 1 week intense, and then everybody goes heads down for 3 months, and then you go 1 week intense, and it kind of goes back and forth. You have to have that, I think. Or you're 100% in person, and you hire everybody in one city, and you make sure that everybody can get into the office. They don't have to come into the office every day, but they need to be able to get into the office. Mm-hmm. If you're like, you know what, we got to do a strategy session on Tuesday. Let's get everybody in. We'll fucking figure it out, right? Sorry, can I swear on this?
Yes, of course.
You are more than allowed.
The Greek version is quite vulgar. So this is actually, this is very interesting because it's what we do at our company this particular week. So we are a remote company as well. We're 5 people. 4 of us are in Athens. We didn't used to be, because the one person was in Thessaloniki. It's in northern Greece.
Yeah.
And we have another person in Nigeria as well. So this is a week that we do this 2 times per year. We get together for a week and we work all day from the office, and we do have a dinner one day or a party another. And it's quite intense compared to the rest,
yeah,
but it's extremely valuable to us. I mean, this, yeah, is the last day of a company meeting.
There are pluses and minuses on both sides of this, and I would recommend, if somebody's listening and they're trying to figure this out, to just choose one or the other, right? Like to not do 60-40 or 50-50 or whatever. Like, don't have an office culture and a remote culture that you're trying to merge and trying to keep people. It's just impossible. That's the worst of both worlds. Like, everybody's in office or everyone's remote. Like it's the easiest to choose one or the other and to go whole hog into that and be like, how do we optimize for this rather than how do we kind of make this work? Because if it's 50-50, then people lose out on conversations, people lose out on context, and people in the office don't know that they're keeping the remote people out of contact. They just don't, they're not aware of it. And then the people that are remote are jealous of it, or they're like, oh, you're keeping me out on purpose, or like there's already these things that kick in when you're not around everybody all the time that only exacerbate. Anyways, so my advice really would be choose one or the other and go entirely into that, and don't make exceptions when you're young, right? When you're under 20 people or 15 people or something. And then after that, then it's fine. The company naturally bifurcates after that anyways, right? Like, you start having departments and you start having teams, and then each team can choose. That was like we talk about GitHub. I talk about GitHub as being 60% remote, but really every team in it, for the most part, was 100% local or 100% remote. Mm-hmm. Like, overall, the company was this percentage, right? Remote or local or whatever. But like, team by team, I think for the most part, like, we really went into everybody needs to be in one place or everyone needs to be remote. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not mixing these teams, but it's on the team to decide kind of what kind of team do they want to be. And then these are the kind of the rules to make sure that team works well.
That was actually, I think that's quite interesting, and it's not something that we hear a lot, because you see companies either being like fully remote or companies being in the office, and now we have this rotation where, you know, you have to be 2 days in the office.
Yeah,
which I personally disagree, but that's like a personal opinion.
Yeah. I mean my opinion on that as well is I guess, I mean, we kind of went into this like hub model, right, where it was like you need to work within a radius of the office, mm-hmm, where you can get in on notice, needed, right? I don't know that it's valuable to be like, okay, you need to be in 3 days a week and then you can work from, like, I mean, at GitHub, the early days, we were all in San Francisco and most of us worked from home most of the time, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't that we didn't even have an office for years. Like, it wasn't that we needed to. It was that we would be like, hey, are you guys working from the cafe today? And then we go to some cafe and we'd all kind of sit there and, you know, buy coffees and kind of work there together. But like, it was the camaraderie or the just being able to have random conversations about stuff. And I feel like there's still a big value in that. Or, yeah, again, you're 100% remote. But like, I think it's weird to put rules around that. If everybody's in the same city or something, like, then yes, everybody, like structure your company so that people can work from home whenever they want to, because then you get a lot of those benefits, right? Like, you can take your kids to school, you can set your own schedule, like, you can hire a wider range of people because they have different, you know, different things on their lives that they have to be able to work around. And the more flexibility then obviously that's great, or have core hours or whatever. But like, really, it's like, okay, here's the meetings for the week. Mm-hmm. We'd like them to be in person, make it. And then everything outside of that, you know, make your decisions, right? Like, you're an adult. Like, it's get your work done, right? Like, it doesn't really matter when you do it or how you do it. It's but when we want to have all six of us in a room together, like, get
let's
in the room.
Let's be able to do so.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask another question about remote, but not this time about working.
Yeah.
But both in GitHub, in Chatterbug, and in GitButler, you have your customers are all around the planet.
Yeah.
So how do you approach this audience? Is it important to get in close to your potential customers? Mm. I mean, go and have a physical presence, do presentations, or you can do all of this online. So
I mean, I think it's a great question. I think it really depends, right? Like, so GitHub and GitButler are both software developer audiences, right? I'm really building a tool for an audience that's very much like me. And so to some degree, I'm my own customer and I can dog food it. And I know very specifically kind of what I think I'm an average developer. I actually don't think I'm a very good developer. But I think that's actually a strong point of mine, in that when I write a book on Git or something, I'm not writing it as the smartest person. I'm writing it as an averagely smart person that struggled with it and is trying to help explain it to people that are coming after them, right? And when I'm writing software development tools, we're not trying to write it for the smartest people, right? The people who wrote Git are trying to write it for the smartest people. The people who wrote GitHub are trying to write it for the average, like, just people who don't want to deal with the most complicated tool set in the world, right? Like, and I feel like there's a huge amount of value in that, of just taking things off people's plates so they don't have to worry about that. They don't have to put a lot of their mental effort into that, that they can worry about other harder, more difficult, more specific problems, and they don't have to worry about version control. Whereas if you're a Linux kernel developer and you want to send patches to the mailing list, like, you have to deal with a lot of Git bullshit that is, like, now that's taking mental space to figure that out. And your whole team has to do that, right? And there's a big overhead to that. I'm sorry, I forgot what the original question was. I was talking about how dumb I was, and then I forgot what my train of thought was. And
that
now
was
I
that was amazing. So the that was quite meta. So the original question was, how is it important to get close to your clients and physically
to
your customers?
Yes, that's right. So again, it depends on the audience. So for the language learning thing, I think it really was because we started in the States, and people in the States don't need to learn another language, and it was a language learning company. And so people in California can use Duolingo for 2 years and be like, I'm learning this language great, and never have to speak the language to anybody, and then they think they've learned the language, and they're like, fantastic. If you never actually have to do it in practice, then just believe that you know Spanish now, right? Like, like, fuck, why not, right? Like, it doesn't really matter. But there's no stakes to that. But in Europe, if you live in Germany and you're trying to learn German, right, or if you live in Spain, you're trying to learn Spanish, like, you have to use it every day. You struggle with it every day. And so we wanted to be close to our customers. I wanted to spend more time in German. I want to learn German because I need to struggle with it every day. Like, I need to feel, if you're writing an app or whatever that tries to help people run marathons, you need to try running a marathon all the time, right? Like, it needs to be the struggle of yours all the time.
So you were dog fooding again.
You have to dog food all the time, I if it's possible, right? I mean, if you're doing some big B2B thing that's writing software for industrial systems or whatever, then it's really hard to dog food your shit. But like, if you're writing software development tools, if you're writing a consumer product, like, you should be using, if you're using a language learning company tool where the CEO of the language of you know, whatever it is, of Duolingo or Babbel, whatever, isn't trying to learn a language with their thing all the time and use, then don't use it. It's useless, right? Like, everybody in that company should be using that. Everybody in the company should be trying to do that. And at GitHub, we were doing that all the time. Our lawyers were using GitHub, right? Like every HR was using GitHub. Everybody was using, we were all using GitHub all the time. And we were constantly dogfooding it. And we had hundreds of, like, and everybody in GitBrother is using GitBrother. Like this is you have to dog food your product. You have to feel the pain if you can. Like if you're in the incredibly wonderful position of being able to be your own customer, right? Of being in the customer space. Not everybody is. Like I happen to have been in three startups that all I could be the customer, right? Like I started a language learning company because I was trying to learn a language and I was struggling with it. And so I felt that pain and I wanted to come up with something better. I started GitBrother because I've been using Git for 15 years and I feel like it hasn't progressed. It's mm-hmm. barely different than it was 15 years ago. And there's nothing that's challenging it. And I think that that's kind of stupid. Like it's not perfect, right? And so why has nobody rethought this and thought like, well, how do we want to be working? What tool set would be good for a software developer? And I am a software developer. So like I want to be in that mindset of let's question all of our tools and figure out how do we make this part of my life better, right? And so I think it is really important to be near your customers if you are your customer. Actually, I'm kind of on a side shoot again, but like this was actually the problem with GitHub is that GitHub was always good for GitHub, right? Mm-hmm. Because we were, it was so close to this. Like we were open source software developers. We built something for people like us, which were small time open source software developers. We weren't good for Linux. We weren't good for you know, the Git project. We weren't good for the Apache projects. Like there are a ton of stuff that couldn't move to us because they were like, any huge open source project, they were like, your tooling is not good for us. Your tooling is good if you have, you know, 100 people using it, right? Or if mm-hmm. 20 people contributing to it. Not if you have 1,000 people contributing to it. It's not a good tool for that. And from a business, because actually one of the weird things that we did is that we had open source projects and corporate projects that were both using it, which very few version control systems really had at the time. Like corporate projects where you use Perforce or use these sort of, you know, ClearCase or TFS. And open source would use Subversion and CVS. And like they were really aimed at different audiences. And we tried to make one tool set for both systems, which had never really happened before at scale. And so like we came in and we built stuff that was good for us. It was good for us what we were doing in open source. It was good for us what we were doing in sort of corporate, you know, like building github.com as a private project. And as we got, so like the tooling was good for a 20-person team when we were 20 people, and it was good for a 100-person team when we were 100 people, and it was good for a 500-person team when we were 500 people. And every time we grew, we're like, oh yeah, that is actually, okay. like we would get feedback from enterprise customers or whatever that's like, oh, we need, you know, like in 2FA or we need single sign-on or we need, you know, whatever, said, integrations.
Why do they need that?
And we're like, well, you're stupid, right? Like we're like, that's a dumb way to work. But like over time, we're like, oh yeah, like you get to that size. And so I feel like we were really kind of constrained to some degree. And the only thing that made us better at that is going to conferences like this, going like, you know, sponsoring beers or whatever, going meeting open source developers and saying like, actually beers are the best. Because okay. Beers, I mean, you know, this sort of Latin phrase in vino veritas, right? Like in wine, there's truth. Like if you get people to drink
to drop
a little,
their defenses,
to drop their defenses, then they, because people are like, I love GitHub. GitHub's the best. And then you give them a couple beers and they're like, you know what sucks about GitHub? And you're like, this is what I'm here for. This is the content I'm here for. And they would tell you what they didn't like about it, what didn't work for them, right? And like, so I think in the end of the day, you do need to be close to your customer. Like you do need to talk to your customer, but you need to get them to be honest with you, which is hard to do sometimes, especially if you have a good product that people like, because they want to tell you how it's good and they don't want to tell you how it sucks. Yeah, we had a lot of feedback from open source developers at points where we would go to conferences and they'd tell us we needed to hear it 3 or 4 or 5 times and be like, okay, this seems to be a pattern. Maybe we're not feeling this internally. We're not feeling this in our open source products, but we see people who are. And so how do we address this in a mm-hmm. way that we can identify with? And that's very, very hard to do, right? Like you need to figure out how do you have communication channels to who feels this pain and know, yeah, I'm relieving this pain in a way that we're not being, like, it's not relieving our pain, but it's relieving somebody else's, and we can have this communication channel open. And it's very, very hard to do, right? Like, it's hard to know you're solving someone's problem if it's not your problem or if you're not your own customer. And so I'm constantly interested in how to do that, because there's just, depending on the market that you're in, there's so many different personas, right? There's so many different types of users of these things. Language learning was awful because there were people like the Americans who don't give a shit, like that don't never really need to use it. And then there's people who found themselves plopped in the middle of Germany and need to speak German like fluently, like in weeks, right, or in months, and you're like, how this just, and some have money, some have don't have money, like how, like what are you targeting, right? It's very difficult. But yeah, if you can be your own customer, that's the best. If you can't, then yeah, you have to set up these communication channels.
So in a previous life with Paris, we did an online ID, like Codespaces before Codespaces. We had the same virtue of, you know, being our own customer and all those things. But what we found out was that this was also like a big trap, because if you think that, you know, whatever is in your mind is the truth about your customers, then maybe you're not heading to the right direction. So how do you try to avoid that situation where you, something that you believe it's a nice feature might not be a nice feature for your main audience?
So I think actually a really, really good, so Chatterbug did not work out very well. It grew, it has 1,000 customers, has like a million ARR or something. Like it has worked. It has lots of customers. It runs. We've kind of moved it over to somebody else to run as more of a lifestyle business, because we couldn't run it to this massive scale that we needed it to be. And so I think actually it is a good example of how, like for me, it was a lesson I learned from that, is how to pay attention if you are the customer, or if you feel you're the customer, to pay attention to what doesn't work for you, rather than trying, if you're a founder or if you're a founding team, or if you're working on something, I think it's very easy to have doubts or to have things that you know don't work and you kind of ignore them, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, people can work around it, people can figure it out, but that any friction point, anything that bugs you, especially as a founder, especially as somebody working on the core product, right? If you're the target customer and you're having problems with it, like I think it's very easy to try to ignore it and be like, everybody else will ignore it, as opposed to paying attention to it and be like, this is the core problem, right? If I'm having problems with this, it's going to be a huge problem for somebody that doesn't care, right? Like that isn't invested in this. And for Chatterbug, what it was, I didn't like showing up for in-person. It was like a face-to-face video thing. Okay. And I'd get nervous, and everybody would get nervous, and people wouldn't want to. And it was a relief to cancel a meeting, right? Okay. Because it's just hard to talk in another language with somebody that you're not good at speaking in that language. And so if it's a relief to not use the product, yep, right? Like, but I really ignored that because I knew it's like I said, it's like a marathon. It's like learning how to run a marathon, right? It's a relief if you don't have to go for a run on a Saturday for 3 hours. Like, it's nice, right? To hurt your ankle or whatever and be like, oh, thank God, I don't have to do this run. Yeah. And like, but if that's the core of your product is that people don't fundamentally want to do it. They just want the output, right? But like, I was ignoring that to some degree and being like, it's like a marathon. People want the output. We just have to get people who care enough about it. But that's not how you build a big business, right? Like, and I was really, really ignoring that, I think, in a fundamental way that was problematic. And I'm trying to be better about that now. And I think we didn't ever really have that problem at GitHub. Like there was just a complete void in the space at the time that we started. And so we really lucked out. And I didn't learn really how to grow a business. Mm-hmm. We just learned how to manage a growing business, right? Which is a little bit of a different thing. Like we had a rocket ship that we had to learn how to handle, as opposed to how to build a rocket ship, which is a completely different thing. And so yeah, I think I'm more cognizant of that, of like what bugs me, and just don't ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. Like make sure this is not a problem, and really constantly it's hard to constantly do that, right? And to loop back and be like, let's say I'm a baby on this, and this is the first time I've used this product, what's going to frustrate me and how do I get rid of that? And it's a discipline. That's difficult to pay attention to. And if you've built a thing, it's embarrassing to pay attention to, because then now you have to know this thing I built and thought was a good idea is frustrating me. And I know I'm the best user of this, right? Like, and
that's true. Yeah. Because you have all the context, the whole context of how this is building, you know, the whole thing. So I wanted to ask, I think, so what was bugging you with Git and you decided to build Git Butler?
Everything bothers me about Git. I mean, if we really want to go into this, how Git Butler started is that I had an angel investing firm with my partner. And so we would invest in companies, and we invested in 20 or 30 companies probably at angel levels. And just in founders or concepts that we really liked. And so one of the ones was a version control system. And, you know, I've been at GitHub, and so I was like, I'm interested. But I've always been fascinated by version control. Like, I know, well, actually, one of the things I really like is to get to know my competitors, right? Like, I want to be best friends with my competitors in everything. So, I know the Atlassian guys. I know the Babel guys from the language learning things. I know the Duolingo guys. Like, I just want to know who's running. Like, we all have similar problems. We're all in similar spaces. Like, we're competing. But like, it's fascinating to be friends with people that are in the same space as you. We invested in this version control system. And it was trying to do more of a Google Docs for version control, like live streaming changes, right? Like to a central server. So you don't have to do commits, you don't have to do checkpoints, you don't have to do sort of like branching and merging in the same way. It's more Google Docs, it's just streaming everything. You can see what everybody in your team's doing. And I think the downside was that you kind of had to, it was its own standalone version control system. So you had to have everybody greenfield it, right? Like you had to have a new project, like you couldn't come into an existing Git project and really be using it. And GitHub struggled with this as well, because we come into companies that were using Perforce or were using ClearCase or TFS or whatever, and we'd be like, hey, use Git. And they're like, well, we can't switch one developer over to Git. Like, there's none of that tooling. We have to come up with a new project, and then everybody has to try out Git and GitHub. Mm-hmm. Yep. And we know it because of open source or whatever. And so it was a struggle for us, right? Like, to get companies onto this. And so I was like, well, if we really look at Git, if we really look at version control about, you know, what do we like? What are we trying to do? What is it good or bad at? Like, Git hasn't changed in 15 years, right?
And it was Git suites now.
And it was written for Linux kernel developers sending mailing lists or patches to mailing lists, right? Like it's not like we've really kind of bastardized it into what we have now with branches and stuff, which was really second order. Like they wanted to build these emails that they could form and send a mailing list. And the whole tool set is really fundamentally built around that. And everything else is kind of bastardized. And you know, I've written whole books on this, and literally three now, probably, like major things of trying to document this and make sense of it for people, because you're trying to move a mindset from what it was written to what people want to use it for. And I think GitHub became popular to some degree by making it accessible, but like it's a good tool, but it's not built for how we write software. And so it became that plus this other version control that Kirill had written, that we had invested in and wasn't really working out. I was like, there has to be something here. Like it's an interesting idea. How has version control not changed? And if you really look at it, it hasn't changed in 15 years, because now everybody's using Git. And it's really set, like when I was going out on stages like this and pitching Git to people that were using TFS and ClearCase and Subversion, CVS and Darks and fucking, you know, Mercurial and everything. Like I was trying to tell people, look at this awesome version control system you've never used. And this is what now I go into things and I give talks on stage. Everyone uses Git. Like, there's nobody here that doesn't use Git, right? Like it is That's really, true. It is really permeated sort of the software development world. But I mean, if you look back to how you fundamentally used CVS or Subversion or RCS or anything, right? You're running git log, you're running a log command, you're running a diff command, you're running merges, you're running branches. Like it's very, very similar, right? Like most of the stuff at a fundamental level, like, yes, this is easier. It's merge before commit or commit before merge, or, you know, you can do like sort of re-enter merge, whatever. Like there's lots of things that it's better at here and there, but nobody's really rethought it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, can it be more like Google Docs, like at a fundamental level? Like, why are we doing commits rather than it saving everything all the time? Why are we on one branch at a time rather than having multiple branches that can kind of be co-located? Like, we can work on two or three or four branches at the same time without it having to be a problem. Why can we not do... if there's going to be a merge conflict, why can't we not work on the merge conflict resolution together, like before the fact, rather than the first person that merges wins and the second person that merges has 100% of the work, right? Like, why do I not know that you and I working on two different branches remotely have merge conflicts before the merge conflict happens 3 days later, right? Like, mm-hmm. why is there no... We're using a central system. Like, we're both pushing our code to GitHub. Like, well, why do I not know as soon as I'm typing on something that you're already working on an active branch that conflicts with mine? There's so many things that we spend so much time on, and nobody's really rethought any of this space in a long time or tried to figure out how do we really want to be working? Like, Google Docs is a good example of... You never run, you know, Google Docs commit, right? Like, you're not mm-hmm. saved, but it saves all of your changes. Like, why don't we have some daemon that's running that's just saving our changes all the time in whatever project that we're working on, so we never lose anything? It doesn't matter what command we run, right? Like, how often do you lose work in Git, right? Like, it's not all the time, but when it happens, it sucks. And it does happen. And so... I guess, sorry, this is the longest possible answer to this. I apologize. But I find it really interesting to... I found it really interesting, I think, at the time, to look at Git and be like, let's just tear all this down. Be like, if we started version control from scratch, but it still needed to work within a sort of GitHub world, like, what does the client look like? Like, what does it look like locally? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want a version control system to do? And there's 1,000 ideas. Like, there's so much that can be done if you're not basing what you're doing off of what Git has done for 15 years, and you're like, how do I really want to work, and what do I value in a system that helps me save work and collaborate and document, right? Which is really what a version control system does. Like, actually, I mean, just from that perspective, like, think about Git commit, right? Like, Git commit really does three different things that are completely orthogonal. Like, you're using Git commit to save work in progress, because if you don't commit, it doesn't save it. And so you'll do, like, work in progress, some bullshit, and you're not really, like, the message isn't really documenting it. It's just saving your work. You do Git commit so you can share the work, because you can't push it anywhere unless you commit it. So you have to commit something. And so you're like, okay, here's some stuff just so I can push it on GitHub so somebody can look at it, right? And so there's that. And then there's documentation, which is, you know, I'm writing a commit message that really documents the work that I'm doing. And so, like, why not separate those into three different tools? That one is, like, just save the work. One is, I want to share the work. And the other is, I want to document the work. And we're just used to this, right? Like, you just don't question the things that you've used for a really, really long time. And I find that fascinating. Like, I just, there's so much interesting stuff that can be done around how do we write code and how do we work together. It's endlessly fascinating to me.
So I remember, one of the most frustrating times that I was writing code and lost work with Git. So I was working on a project of a client. And the project was created by another person, and they had set up Git hooks, so pre-commit hooks.
Yeah.
So I couldn't commit my work if it wouldn't pass some sort of linting or formatting, I don't remember. And because I've just started working on this project, I didn't have the appropriate node version on my computer. I don't remember, something like that. So I was postponing the time I would commit my work, because it wouldn't let me. I was trying to commit because it would break, and I wanted to do some progress. It would work when I would run the program, but it wouldn't work when I tried to commit, because it would run another anyway command. So somehow I lost my work because I was postponing the time that I would commit, because I wasn't able to do this because of that. And I was thinking, I would really have hoped for me to be able to decouple checkpointing my work and actually packaging it to share with the rest. That was quite frustrating. I remember that.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find really fascinating, right? Is what what are we really trying to do? Like, what do we want to be doing as we're working? Because most of us, we're software developers. We just want to work on software. We don't want to do branch management. We don't want to do, most of us really don't want to do review, which is kind of fascinating. One of the things that we're working on, I mean, we're a young company, right? We're trying to kind of spitball things. But like, one of the things I find fascinating, the more that I look at it, is the review process, because most people hate reviewing, because reviewing is really difficult. And one of the reasons why it's really difficult is because GitHub, partially it's GitHub's fault. So partially it's my fault, if you really think about it. But like, because we do review on per branch basis. And so then people try to do stacked branches or whatever. And stacked branches are really just, it's the same as reviewing individual commits, right? It's just then not having to rewrite the commits. So each branch is really then a commit, because there's a dependency between them. And so it's like, what's the difference between like a stacked branch and like three commits that you can just, it's just that you can't review a commit. You can only review the unified diff of the whole branch. And the other problem with reviews is that you can't make them very rich. You have a description in one tab, and then you have the unified diff in another, and then you can go and like add in commit or add in comments, and then they kind of go into the other tab, right? And so it's kind of separated. Whereas, so I'm working on a thing right now, which is kind of like a branch notebook, like a Jupyter notebook, mm-hmm. where you have like the diffs, and you can rearrange them into whatever order. Because the other thing is like you'll look at a file and then a test, and they'll be at completely opposite ends of the unified diff, right? Yeah. Like one's at the top of the thing and one's at the total bottom, and they're like they should be next to each other, and there should be a description that says this is what I'm trying to do here, and then they're calling this, and then there's another section with another rich text or some images or whatever. Like it should be a document that's like read through this, and some of the diffs are squashed because it doesn't really matter, right? It's like entries into a TOML file or whatever, and you're like, I'm just adding some dependent, like review it if you want, but like who gives a shit? Like that's not really important. What's important is the logic in the things that it depends on, right?
Or like a log file, or you
say. Or log files, right? Like PNPM shit, right? Like it whatever it is, like you should be able to say this is important. Look at this. This is not important, or this is for front end developers. This is for back end developer. Like I need a TypeScript review on these things, and I need Rust review on these things, right? Like whatever it is, but like I feel like we should have way more control over how to write up the like code changes that we're making to make it easy as possible for the reviewer. So they're reading a story and then looking at the code changes, and maybe it's line by line, or maybe it's in like, side by side, or like maybe it's compressed, or like you can kind of add comments here. And like, you don't have to put code comments in the like, you can just add them after the fact. And like, there's so much cool shit we can do to make it easy on the reviewer to read a story about here's what I'm trying to do with this branch, right? And you're like, okay, that all looks good, or here's my comments, or whatever. And so I'm excited about stuff like that, of just looking at how we've been working for 10 years and being like, is this the best way to do this? Or like, what are the things that are frustrating to people that you skip, right? Like, that if somebody sends you a PR and it is 30 files and 1,000 lines, that you're not going line by line, right? And really putting the story together. No, you're like, right. Yeah, it looks good to me. Like, but that shouldn't be it, right? Like, you should be able to kind of put this together how you wrote it, right? And if the version control system is recording sort of CRDTs of like line by line how this happened, like I can help you say, here's the order in which you grouped files or you edited files. Like I can help you tell the story. You can use AI to be like, tell a little story about like, why do you think that they did this in this order, in this manner, or what were they trying to accomplish, right? Like we can do it back. I don't know. There's lots of interesting things. I don't have all the answers, but like I feel like what's interesting is asking the questions of what doesn't work. Right. And what do we take for granted because we've just been using it for a long time and there's nothing better. And so we're like, it's fine. Like, this is just how it works. Right. I think figuring out how you get frustrated and how you'd like to work, like what would be ideal, right. In being able to collaborate with people. Like, I would love just to go back to the merge conflict thing. Like, none of us had merge conflicts before distributed version control systems in the same way. I mean, CVS and stuff, but you couldn't commit until you merged at that point, right? And so you'd have a massive merge conflict that would be really horrible. And you're like, well, never mind, right? Like if you're in CVS and Git made that a little bit better, but like it offputs it to when you want to contribute. You can contribute all the time and feel like, oh, I have no problems. and you're buying happiness from the future, right? You're like, this is just going to be a problem days from now rather than when I want to save my work, which is what it used to be.
But if you merge first,
then you're fine, right? Like, nobody's tried to solve that problem, and it's totally solvable, right? Like there are ways to, I think, like, what if you guys saw that you were having merge conflicts and you could see what it was and you could work on the conflict resolution and then it didn't matter beforehand and you could agree on it beforehand and then it didn't matter which branch was merged first because the second one would just automatically have the conflict resolution you've already agreed upon and had a conversation about and had like figured out this is what we want it to be if they're both merged. If one or the other is merged, then we can throw it away, right? Like I like the idea of trying to figure out how do we get around these things that are constantly frustrating.
So this can be very useful, especially if you are working on database stuff, because let's say you're working in front-end development. So, okay, what's the worst case scenario? You're going to spend a lot of time that you need to rearrange code. If, for example, we are using Django when we write backend in our applications. So Django produces migrations for the database when you change the models and all that stuff. I guess in Rails is in a similar situation. Yeah. The thing there is that when you have conflicts in that level, you have even more implications than just having different code. You might need to drop your database or locally or, you know, do more weird workflows. And if you can catch this, the earlier that you can resolve this, it can be much, much easier. I was actually talking with a person from another company here and was saying that this is one of the worst problems they have in their company because they're a big company, they're working with Django, and if three or four people work on migrations that change the same model at the same time, and one asks for the other person to review their work while they already have a branch that did migrations on their own computer, they just cannot review it. So let's say you have a model and you remove a field from that model. This in Django will create an automated file that makes the database migration. So you have run this migration, you have applied it in the database locally, so you have the new schema. And let's say I or Antonis are working on changing this model in another way than you. And I have a problem. And I say to you, hey, can you please help me with this thing? I can't get this working. Can you please check out my branch locally?
Yeah.
And you check out my code, but it's not consistent with the database that you have created and have added.
I feel like that's almost a separate problem, which is the problem of having version databases. Like you can do, I think with Neon there's a couple of like Postgres databases where you can have version databases where you can
according
say
to branches.
Yeah. Okay. So you have like a database per branch, right? And you can switch back and forth between them or something.
Because
in the end, so I mean, there's another, like, there's lots of other sort of problems with software development, like any dependencies that you have, right? Like you know, Redis or Postgres with us, we have Git repositories that we have to sort of have in the back. It's hard to test some of this stuff, right, without sort of all these data structures in place, but I think what is interesting is trying to figure out, okay, like if you can version your database or if you could do rollbacks and restores in a useful way, then yes, you can switch branches. Or if you can merge them and have, what will this look like when it gets to production? Mm-hmm. And let's make sure that these two branches work together beforehand, but still have the capability of being able to merge them in any order, right? Like that is interesting. Like I think a lot of companies like Facebook and Google and stuff are trying to go more towards monorepos and more towards sort of single line histories, right? Where everything's like stacked reviews or you know, bisectable or something like that. And I think it's interesting. People ask me this a lot of like merge or rebase, right? And I think it doesn't really matter. Right. What matters is, does your tool set work well with however your history is? I think that merges are better because it has more history and you can just do sort of a single parent and essentially get the same thing as if you'd squash merged everything. It doesn't really matter. So you can still do bisects and stuff. But in the end, what you want is the tool set that you use, the things that you're trying to get out of your code history, it works with whatever your database looks like, whatever your code data, Git history or something looks like. And so what I'd like to move towards, I suppose, is having a little, I feel like it was almost a mistake. But one of the problems that I see a lot now is that GitHub will allow you to merge, rebase, or squash merge a PR, and every team chooses a different thing. And so now there's all these opinions on kind of how to deal with that data set that mm-hmm. comes out of that after the fact. And I think it would be better to have, I guess, come up with a tool set that works well under one very specific circumstance, right? And not give people the choice to really have these different sort of ways that they can do stuff. But mostly because it's the tooling, right? Like it's the tooling, like what are you trying to do with this that becomes important at that point?
Well, I think that when you reduce the available options, then you create better workflows. But I mean, Git started with, you know, sky's the limit, you can do everything you want. And then you had GitHub where you have a main branch and then you do PRs or, you know, you put some structure into it and then slowly you can put something like on top of it. So in GitHub, you had like 100 options. Now you have like 50. So what are the correct 50 options? And maybe after, you know, 10 or 15 years with working this way, because this like a new paradigm, then you can start thinking of how you can move towards a solution that works for 80% of the people with a great way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, sorry, to go, I guess we're talking about the same thing, but I think the problem is, somebody was telling me recently that the problem is that the pull request is really the first order interesting object, right? Like
it's like the auto.
Like it really shouldn't matter every commit in between. That's kind of not how we're treating it. So they're like, oh, you can squash merge, and then the pull request is sort of the atomic unit, right? Mm-hmm. Like then every commit is essentially a squashed pull request because you're not pushing directly stuff to master. Or you do a merge and then just the merge commits are sort of the atomic thing because that's the pull request. If you rebase, you're losing all of that, actually. Mm-hmm. Rebasing, I think, is the worst option of these. It does create a linear history, but you're losing the data in the pull request, which really ends up being like what the patch series used to be, mm-hmm. right? Like what the commit message used to be. It's the pull request for a GitHub centered workflow is the important information. Like each individual commit is like essentially not interesting anymore because you're not re-rolling series, right? You're not re-rolling a branch. You're not doing review on a per commit basis. And so then people have to do stack diffs and stuff to kind of get around that because they want the pull request to be the atomic unit of work. And I think it should be like, I think that really, that kind of what that is what commits used to be in the mailing list sort of workflow. And that's what pull requests have come away from a little bit because people don't want to re-roll and force push. And there's just too much Git work around that. Right. And so I think that's where we'll go, right. Is that there's this idea of some trunk, right. Some trunk based development or something. And people will have something like a pull request, right, where it's like, here's a proposal for a unit of work, and you're like, here's some review, and you can chunk it up to some degree, and you can describe it, and then you can review it, and then you can update it in an easy way, and then when it's all done, you merge it in as kind of one atomic mm-hmm. unit of work, and like, that's where we want to go. We're just not quite there, right? Like we're all working around what we want this model to be in various ways, and I think it'll be interesting to see kind of what the collaboration workflow looks like in a couple of years.
So the idea would be like you start streaming to your open PR and then doesn't matter when you commit. And then at some point you have this atomic unit, which is the PR. Then you
document it at the end, right? Yep. Or it documents it, or you document it over time. How nice would it be actually to start working and to open up commits and start putting work into commits before they're committed and start describing them and start mm-hmm. documenting them. And then you just at the very end, you're like, okay, now this is done. And it kind of codifies everything, right? Like you can't do that. Like you have to wait until the very, like shift left on all this stuff, right? Like you have to wait until the very end to do any of this work. And it's very frustrating for people, I think, because you're not in that mind space anymore.
I think that every team reinvents the wheel in to find a way to do so. So what, for example, what we usually do is we open up a draft pull request, and then we just send commits as we work, and we update the description as the moves as this moves on. And then when we have moved to a place where we try to make as meaningful descriptions as we can. We were actually having this discussion the other day that descriptions should also be useful for the person that will review the pull request, which is a work in progress as long as this is in draft. Yeah. And when this is ready, we mark this as ready for review. So this is our own way that we have invented inside the company to do something to me sounds close to what you are describing. So I guess every company tries to find a way to checkpoint their work, you know, keep some sort of notes. And indeed, it would help a lot if all of us had a common language around, sounds like a common need to me.
Yeah, no, I think the main thing is that software developers are, you get into a flow and you know what you're doing and you have everything in your head and you want to describe what you're doing when you're doing it to somebody. You want to be in that flow and say, okay, here's what I'm doing, and then you do it. Or you do it and then you say, here's what I'm doing. You don't want to do stuff for 3 days and then go back and remember what it was you were doing and try to take the time to put it together and to document it and to write commit messages and to describe it to somebody and open the pull request and write the description. Like I feel like what would be nice is to wait, is to shift all the way to when you're writing the code and give you the tools to describe it at that time. What's your mindset? What are you trying to do? How are you writing this? What are you trying to accomplish, right? Like, and the tools aren't there for that right now. You have to work around the tools that we have. You have to work around getting GitHub and what they allow you to do. And if you want to do something complicated, then you have to do more and more complicated things in Git that become more and more dangerous. And then you have to get everyone on your team to be able to do that as well, which becomes an exponential problem. And I think the answer is just to let developers do what they want to do when they want to do it, right? Which is not really what the tool set allows right now. And so, yeah, I mean, part of it, yeah, I have this company and we're trying to solve that to some degree. Maybe we'll nail it. Maybe we'll completely fail, but I think somebody will at some point, right? Like, I think this is not how we're going to write code forever. We'll shift into, I'm documenting as I'm writing it some way or another, because that's the headspace I'm in, and that's how I describe it to somebody, and that's how I communicate to somebody who wants to look at it or wants to review it or wants to understand it, how to do this thing.
And also, if you think about it, it's also a bit easy when you want to go back to the code, because currently, after, doing the PR, doing the review, merging the PR, this is just code in your repository and all this information is lost. So somehow persisting that metadata that you somehow, you put into the review, you do the work of documenting, of doing all that stuff, and now you lose everything. So maybe that metadata can live alongside the code somehow.
Yeah, ideally, I think we would have version control tools or documentation tools or something that would be able to pull in sources that had more context. Like, how nice would it be if you had a Slack bot that was in your engineering channel and took all the conversations that you guys had in Slack about code, or all the conversations you had in GitHub about code or about issues or whatever that were related to this thing, and you were working on a function, you're like, tell me a story, like, tell me how this function came to be, right? And it was like, oh, no problem. It started with this issue because of the Sentry thing that, we were getting errors, and then Scott took it over and he wrote it in this way, and he had these conversations with Kirill, and they figured out that the best way to solve this would be this, and then that's why it turns out to be this way, right? Like, that context is there, right? Like, it's most of that's online. Like, it's there are artifacts for that, but we don't have access to any of that data unless we go through for an hour and dig it all up. And so I think LLMs help with this type of thing. Like, it'd be really nice to feed all of this into a company LLM or something and be like, just describe this function to me. And it's like, okay, well, here's, now it's the senior developer that has all the context in the world and can be like, yeah, this is issue 72. And they worked on this and they argued over this, and this is what the output was, and it's causing these errors in Sentry, right? Like that type of thing would be amazing, but and we have all the data, it's not accessible.
Today, usually it's like, I have no fucking idea why this came to be, and
yeah, you just edit it and create new problems, yeah, and it's fine.
So this is for me, I run into situations like this more often than I'd like, because I'm you pinpoint the problem, you try to, through Git blame, to go back to where this thing was, and then you... there are multiple times where I run into a commit that has all tons of unrelated work because it was like, it was work accumulated through lots of time. And I really don't know what that person had in mind when they wrote this particular piece of code.
Yeah.
Because there's Python code changes, documentation changes, Dockerfile changes, JavaScript changes, CSS changes that have been accumulated for that much time without any checkpoints and the ability to document. And super important. So what makes you more about Git? But what's the one thing that you wish?
One thing?
Yeah.
That is a great question.
Or,
what is the
one what's your thing? What's your favorite feature of Git Butler? You can say, you can...
Well, so right now we have the thing called virtual branches where you can be on more than one branch at a time. Like, one central thing about every version control system, I think, is that you're always on one branch, right? Like,
okay.
And so Git has this the head and the index, and it's always one branch that you're working on. And we came up with this interesting thing, which was I can be working on a feature branch and then see a bug and then fix the bug and just drag it into branch B, right? Okay. And commit it as though it was the only thing and push it up and get it integrated, but I don't have to take it out of my working directory. Like, right now, you have to be like, okay, well, I'll either stash everything I'm doing and fix the bug and push it up, or just commit it into my feature branch and just assume that they're not really related, but like, I saw it when I was doing this and I don't want to switch context, right? And I like the idea. It's actually very valuable to me to not have to care what context I'm in, to just be like, okay, I'm working on this thing. I see something else. I'll move into another context, but like, I can be in both of them at the same time, or I can pull down your remote branch and I can apply it simultaneously and see what it looks like if it was merged with mine, right? With my work in progress or something. And I don't have to switch context. And I think switching context is why Git has been powerful, is because it's easy. It's easy at doing that. But I feel like what the question that hasn't been answered is, what if we didn't have to switch contexts, right? Like, what if we could have multiple contexts? What if there are layers in Photoshop or something, right? I can be in all these contexts and I can choose which ones I want to have at the same time. And to traditionally do that, you have to create merges and then maybe undo merges or something, right? But like, to get it into your working directory, you have to do a merge. And so like, I've really enjoyed working with the Git Butler client in the last couple months of just, I don't have to do a lot of branch management, right? It creates a branch when I don't have one and I start doing work and it sees that. Like, it's saving work for me all the time. I don't have to do work in progress commits. If I start working in another context, I just create another context and just have the work start going into that. I can commit it and push it completely separately, right? Like, I don't have to choose which branch I'm in at a time. We're young and this is what I love using in the alpha that we're doing right now. But I think in the future, there's just so many things that we deal with all the time that we don't think about that much. And when it's off your plate, it's fantastic.
You can go back.
Yeah. I mean, it's frustrating, right? It's frustrating to not have that tool set in your arsenal.
So the idea of Git Butler is like porcelain for Git porcelain.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because if you think about it, like, Git is really, it's really five different tools, right? Mm-hmm. That do different, completely orthogonal things. The only thing they really all have in common is a centralized database, right? Like, there's just this database of commits and this directed graph of snapshots. And Git log works on it, Git blame works on it, and Git commit, you know, adds to it, and Git push, you know, moves it. But like, they could all be different tools. Like, you don't really need them to all be in one tool set. They just, it's like Postgres, that there's an ORM and there's a BI tool or something, mm-hmm. right? Like, they use the same data set, but like, they do very, very different things. And so we're just trying to look at each one and be like, what would be a better thing for this, right? What is a better way of getting data out of this? Or what is a better way of getting data into this? Like, how do you really want to be working? And I find that fun to just think about Git as a database and figure out what is the, not a porcelain on a porcelain, but just, you know, what's a completely new porcelain that, you know, shits the same shit.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so the idea of Git Butler is to work on top of Git, so you still use the same database, but...
The push is the same, the database is the same, but we can write it however we want to write it. We can formulate the data however we want to put it together. But yeah.
So I had another question.
Yeah.
What is the feature of Git that you believe more people should know about?
So there's a two, I think, recently that I've been talking about at conferences, because I feel like people, it's very valuable. They're very valuable, and almost nobody knows about them. One is something called re, which is reuse a recorded resolution. So there's a git config setting that you can say re, git config re dot enable true. And if you're doing rebasing and you solve a merge conflict, it will remember left side and right side and what the conflict resolution was. And if it sees it again, it will reuse the existing. Wow. So you don't have to, if you've ever had the same merge conflict twice, then you're wasting your time. You can make Git remember that and reuse it again. So that's very useful if you're doing rebasing. The other is Git blame has some really nice features that should probably be default. One is dash lowercase w, which is ignore white spaces. So if somebody went in and changed all the tabs to spaces or something,
dash, why does GitHub not have this on my fault?
It's my fault too, because I wrote the initial implementation to Git blame, and I don't think it's been touched a lot since then, because not that many people use, I think, the GitHub blame implementation. But like even in VS Code or whatever, I don't think it uses these options. So dash lowercase w ignores white spaces. And then there's dash capital C, which looks for code movement. So if you copy a function and then move it to another place in the file, it will not see you as the author. It'll see whoever originally wrote those lines as the author. But interestingly, sorry, we can end pretty soon here. if you do dash capital C once, it looks for code movement within a file. Dash capital C twice, it looks for code movement within a commit. So you can copy it from one file to another file. And if you blame that second file, it will show you the edits from the first file. It'll show you the person who originally wrote those lines. Wow. Or touch them last before the move. It won't look at the movement, right? It'll ignore the movement. And if you do dash capital C three times, so this is git blame dash w dash capital C dash capital C dash capital C, all in the command line, then the third one will look across commits. So you can delete a function in one commit and then add it into a different file in a second commit, and it will see that movement, and it will attribute it to the original author, right? So you can make it. It's more expensive, like it takes more CPU.
This is what I was about.
Yeah, it's more expensive, which is why it doesn't do it by default, I think. But it's not that expensive. Like none of this stuff is really that bad unless you have a massive code base. But like, just make it, you know, a git alias or something of like git really blame and dash lowercase w dash capital C three times and be like, okay, like really try to figure out who wrote, like who last really touched this in a meaningful way. And and so those are the two things I think people should know more about.
I think that's very useful. Actually, I didn't know, I knew dash w, but not dash c.
Yeah.
And many times you find out they have a function and then it has been moved and then it's shit. So it's the same. I will not just bother, you know, trying to find out what's happening there.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, you really think about it. Like how nice would it be to just be in your editor and on those lines and be like, tell me a story about this function, right? Like that's what we want. Like git blame in its best is still heuristic, right? It's still not, and it's still the last person that touched the line. It's not really who came up with this, who was the product manager, what was the use case, like that. There's more valuable context I think around that we're missing, and git will never solve, right? Because it will never really have that data, and so there has to be something that's built up that has access to the data and can answer that in an interesting way.
Sounds good. I mean, it's like storytelling for Git commits.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that's a nice point to start wrapping up. I mean, we can continue as much as we want, but
I think we got a party coming up.
I know. We'll go get some drinks.
Yeah.
It was amazing for me, at least. That was
for me.
Really nice conversation, and it was a great chance to have you here. So wrapping up, we have a section where you can propose things from products, books, you know, whatever you want. You can either go first or last, depends on you, whatever you want.
It's a good question. I would say, I mean, from a product perspective, obviously, I would say if you're willing to join the GitButler alpha and help us test out some of this stuff. We're a little bit early, but like everything works and we've been using it for a couple months. You can go to gitbutler.com and sign up with a mailing list, or you can go to our Discord and just ask me and I'll immediately give you access to it. We just kind of want to kind of screen for, you know, people that are interested in the community. And then Yeah. So from a product perspective, the let's see, what's another interesting product? I feel like I had something the other day. And then from a book perspective, I would say this is not a business book. This is just, I love sci-fi.
Oh, nice.
And I read a book that I really liked recently called Children of Time. If I had one recommendation, it's about spiders in space. So a little bit weird, but it is a fantastic sci-fi book that was one of the last ones that I read and I really enjoyed. So I'll go Children of Time.
Yeah, sounds good. Buddy, any proposals?
Yeah, I'll go next. I proposed a podcast last time. I'll do this again. So there's a podcast called The Changelog, which is about open source software and all sorts of different stuff that I find super interesting. The last episode was about a virtual machine management tool that you can run on Ubuntu that runs very small, tiny virtual machines, which I don't remember the name, but I found it super interesting. So yeah. That's my take.
I think Changelog actually is a combination of different podcasts and they have a selection or something.
It might be.
Anyway. So I will do like the simplest stuff. I would propose GitHub Flow. I believe that like that's the best way to work when it comes to PRs and that kind of stuff. I think that today's podcast is very related to that. So sounds good. So yeah, I mean, thanks a lot, Scott, for being here with us. It was our pleasure. Hopefully we'll meet again sometime soon.
And yeah. Thank you for having me. I really, really enjoyed it. And thank you for picking me up in the rain.
No worries. I mean, it's not very common to have rain in Athens. So it was one of the hard days, you know, but we figured it out. It's fine.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for listening. And yeah.
See you next time.
Bye. Cheers.